Jim O'Brien, Peter Brock here.
How are you, sir?
I am excellent this morning. You know why?
Why?
I'm talking to you.
Oh, look at you with the positive attitude. It is an absolute honor to talk to you again. We spoke a couple of years ago, and when I found out you're going to be here for the American Speed Festival, oh, come on. This is as cool as it gets, Pete.
Well, great. I'm so super to get back with you.
We're celebrating 70 years of Shelby, and everybody, you know, for folks who don't know, it's going on this weekend, Friday through Sunday here at M1 Concourse. The weather's beautiful, by the way. We're going to have upper 60s, clear skies, perfect track weather to get out there.
Excellent.
Yeah, you got to have good weather. But the Shelby Daytona, the Cobra Coupe, tell people who don't know the story how you created this.
Well, it was a very interesting problem, Jim. You know, when we first built the Cobras in the United States, Carroll's only real goal was to build something that was going to be faster than the Corvettes. And we saw that by 1963, we had won the United States Road Racing Championship with the cars, and we had, you know, all the top drivers. We had, you know, Dan Gurney, and we had Bob Bondurant. We had Ken Miles, of course, and Dave McDonald and stuff. And, I mean, these guys just mowed everything down on the club racing. And at that point, Carroll thought, you know, it would be really great if we could go back to Europe. But when we were running on the American tracks, which are about an average of about 2.5 miles, we never really got over about 140 to 150 miles an hour. And the car had a top speed. They tried to run it. AC had tried to run the cars at Le Mans. And they only had a top speed time there of 163 miles per hour. So I had mentioned to Carroll, I said, you know, there's a really an arcane part of the Appendix J rules that would allow us to put a whole new body on the existing chassis. And I think I can design a body that will give us that extra speed. I said, when I was working at General Motors, I found some papers that had been written in the 1930s by a German named Reinhard König von Paschenfeld. And he had made some experiments. He was a young aristocrat and raced motorcycles, had won the world the German championship in 1924, and had become interested in aerodynamics and trying to figure out how to make his motorcycle faster. And he had also worked for a very well-known early designer, a guy named Paul Jarret, who had designed the ideal shape for the Zeppelins, which had a long, long tapering tail. And his influence had influenced all automotive design up to that point. Everybody thought that the best shape for an automobile was something with a long tail. But if you look at the comparison of a Zeppelin and a car, you can't make a car, you know, an extra, you know, 15 feet longer than the car.
Right.
So if people would bring the tail down and, you know, it was a very zoomy looking thing at that time, but it was very inefficient. And he discovered that, you know, in spite of these cars looking very good with a drop tail on what they called a fastback at that time, if you look at a 49 Cadillac or something like that, that's an ideal example. It was not very aerodynamic, and he figured out that the smartest way to do it was to take the roof flat back, keep the air attached to the roof, and then just chop it off and sort of fool the air into thinking that it was going to stay attached, because it was keeping the air attached to the surface that made it really slippery. And the minute you turned the roof too much, it began to turbulate, and you had all of this turbulent area behind the car, which slowed it down. So I had been working with Bill Mitchell at that time on the design of the Stingray Corvette, which
right.
I was 19 years old, you know. And you know, I was directed by Mitchell, of course, but I was doing everything he wanted and stuff. And I showed him some sketches on this, and I said, you know, Mr. Mitchell, you know, we ought to take a look at the possibility of, you know, maybe chopping the back end of the car off a little bit. And he looked at that, and he looked at me, and he says, that is the ugliest looking shit I've ever seen. Now, will you just do what I tell you, you know?
I love that.
So anyway, it didn't lend itself. There was nothing that related to everybody's feeling of what a good form was supposed to be, like the Stingray with the tapering back on it. So when I got out to California and was working for Carroll, and he said, you know, I'd like to make this thing faster, but I don't know how to do it. And I said, well, if you listen to what I'm going to say, I think I can make it a pretty fast car. So I explained the whole thing. I didn't tell him that I'd worked for GM as an automotive designer. I just told him I wanted to be a race driver, and I was running his driving school.
Oh, so you never told him? You never told him that, Pete?
No. I my whole goal was to be a race driver.
Right.
So I never mentioned it to him. But then at that point, I said, you know, I can design this thing for you and build a pretty fast car. And so I explained the whole thing about the flat chopped off tail and stuff. And he just said, that's a, you know, if that was true, you know, here, this is stuff designed in 1930, and here we are in 1960, you know, 65 or so, and that's 30 years ago. People would have figured that out and used it. And I said, well, I said the problem was is that nobody really knew what this guy had done when the war came along, and all that stuff was lost. And I said, we, the American military, happened to find these papers and made copies of them. And because they were related to automotive design, they sent a copy to each American company. And this was stuff was just, you know, old mimeograph stuff, that old, you know, gelatin
right.
on paper type stuff. And there was a series of about six pages, I think. And it was all in German. And, you know, it had some graphs and little sort of hen scratchings on it and stuff. And I couldn't read the German, but I could read the numbers of the improvements on it. I said, God, this is really incredible. And so I showed it to Meginal. Of course, it didn't go anywhere, but I sort of put all that information away, and I said, this is really important. So I relayed all of this stuff to Carol, and he said, you know, that's really stupid. He said, you know, people would have figured that out a long time ago. And I said, well, I said, the Germans really knew what they were doing, Carol. And I said, it's worth a chance to do something like this. And he said, well, I know that Ford is working on a new trick car, and I can't go to Ford for any money. You know, they've given us a little bit of money for the Cobra program, but there's right. no money to do it. So you might as well forget it. And I said, well, we can get this thing built in a few weeks, literally put a new body on the Cobra. And I said, it'd be worth it if you can get some money together to do it. So he was kind of intrigued, but, you know, he just didn't believe it. So he went to our chief engineer, Phil Remington, who was probably the greatest race car builder in the United States and the guy who I have tremendous respect for, and explained what I wanted to do. And it was the same thing as what Mitchell, he looked at it and said, that's just not going to work, you know. So just told Carol to forget it. It's a dumb idea. He says, Ford's got this new GT40 program, and they're, you know, they're working with Eric Broadley and Malolo over there, and that's going to be a supercar. So forget it. So at that point, Ken Miles came to Carol quietly and said, you know, Pete knows what the hell he's talking about, because I know a little about what the Germans are doing, having been in England and seen it, you know, before the war, what the Germans were doing. And he said, Brock knows what he's doing. And he says, it's worth trying. So Carol was really divided, because here we have the two really important guys in the company, Ken Miles, who wants to do it, and Phil Remington, who's telling him it's a dumb idea. So Carol understands the value of exposure. So he says, whether you get good publicity or bad publicity, they're still mentioning your name. So he said, I'll try to figure out a way to get some money to build this car, because I know it'll get us a lot of publicity. Imagine we build this incredibly different looking car and go to Europe, and we're going to get a lot of, you know, exposure on it.
Right.
So he happened to be the distributor for Goodyear tires on the 11 Western states. So he went to lunch with the head of Goodyear at that time, Larry Truesdale, and a guy named Tony Webner, and talked him into it. You know, I did my whole spiel of how that thing worked, and he, you know, Carol could create a great story. So he convinced them that I had a good idea, and that Ken was behind the thing, and it was Ken and my responsibility to do this thing. So Goodyear put up the money. They said, okay, we'll give you a few thousand dollars to build this body, and you can test it out. So, of course, this created a great division in the shop, because Remington felt that Carol had gone against him, and it, there was a great, really some division. So he'd asked me to make a presentation to all the guys in the shop, and I made a presentation. And of course, there was complete silence because the thing was such a strange looking thing, and they all thought it was a dumb looking car as well. And they just said, well, we're not going to work on this thing. It's going to be a loser. And we've got too much other stuff around here. We've got a new King Cobras, you know, built on Cooper chassis to build. We've got customer race cars to build. There's all kinds of stuff for us to do. So we're not going to do it. So Ken said, look, give me a couple of the new guys that you just hired that are not part of this California group. And Peter and I and the new guy will build it. So Phil Mennings has selected a young New Zealand guy that had just come to work for us, a guy named John Olson. And the three of us built the first Daytona Cobra. And what happened is that I designed the whole thing in quarter scale, and then I scaled it up using a 35-millimeter camera, and I photographed all my lines because I'd, of course, made a full set of drawings on it, you know, plan view, front view, rear view, side view, and everything. And I photographed it, and with 35-millimeter slides, I blew them up on the wall onto butcher paper. And so I had the outlines of every section there, and then we stapled those to pieces of 3/4-inch plywood, and then just took a jigsaw and cut out all these shapes and put this thing together like a giant ice cube tray. So now, for the first time, people could see what the car really looked like full scale. And that was placed on a standard Cobra chassis, and we took that downtown to a very well-known company that had some big power hammers that made aluminum panels for Indy cars, all kinds of stuff. But these hammers had been made originally for World War II aircraft construction. So they hammered out all these panels, and we put them back over this wooden framework we built. And these guys put this thing together in the 90 days.
Wow.
Now, we're doing it over in a corner of the shop, and everybody's giggling and saying, God, that's Brock's folly. What a dumb-looking car. You know, the back end's chopped off, and the roof's all strange-looking or whatever. So we took it out to Riverside on February 1st, 1964. I remember the date really well. And Ken got in the car, and, I mean, he hardly went any laps at all and came back, and he says, what kind of gear we got in? I said, Ken, it's exactly your roadster. We made it so you could make it directly correct. And he said, well, I don't believe it. So we jacked the car up and turned the wheels, and it was sure enough checked out. So he went back out again. He came back, and he says, I can't believe it. He says, this thing is so fast. He says, I'm coming out so much faster. And he said, we didn't only had a tachometer in there, and so we didn't know really what the top speed was, but we figured out later it was over 180 miles an hour.
Good Lord.
So he went immediately up to the phone and called Carol and told him what was going on. We'd gone 3.5 seconds a lap faster. And, I mean, that was just an incredible number. You know, if you build a new car and you went out and you got 2 or 3 tenths quicker, that would be an impressive
deal. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, it just changed the world. So Carol went down to the shop and he says, I don't care what all you guys say. When these guys get back from Riverside, this is going in the center of the shop, and I want everybody to get on it. And here are the times, you know, and they were all flabbergasted. They couldn't believe it. But Ken showed them all the times. So they all dived in, and we got the car ready to run at Daytona the very first time, and we went down there. And then Bob Holbert was the first guy to drive the car, and he got back after a couple laps, and he says, it's no contest. He says, I can come out of that corner so much faster than the Ferraris, and I'm leaving them down the street. He says, you know, what we ought to do is back the red line down on the engine, slow it down a little bit, and we'll be competitive with the Ferraris, and then we'll get better gas mileage. So that's what we did, and that was our plan for the race, is to just run our engine slower so we'd get better gas mileage. So we made a rough calculation. We didn't have any exact method to measure it, but we could fill the tank, run a few laps, put some fuel back in it, and calculate what we had. So we figured we were about 20 to 25% more fuel efficient with this new shape, which was just an incredible amount. So that was the way we would run, you know, with the Ferraris. And as soon as they'd pit, well, we'd gain 2 laps on them. By the time they came out again, we're 2 laps ahead. So the car was just, you know, so much faster.
So,
and everywhere we went, it broke the lap record at Daytona with both Dave McDonald and Bob Holbert driving. Then we went to Sebring for the next race. We had a big fire at Daytona. We were leading the race by about 4 to 7 laps at that time. And we had a fire in the pit, which is another long story, which I won't get into. But anyway, we didn't finish the race. But we knew the car was fast, so we took it back to California, fixed the fire stuff, damage and everything on it, and went to Sebring. And again, set the lap record with the car, won the GT race. And, of course, by this time, Ford was supposed to have the new GT40s out, and they didn't show up. So Ford was looking at us with this car, and they're spending millions of dollars on the GT40, and we built this thing for $1.98, and we're smoking all the Ferraris and stuff. So now, you know, the Ford guys are looking at us fairly seriously. And when we win the race at Sebring, the 12 hours there, Henry Ford said, well, we're not ready with our car. Let's put some money on, more money to Carroll, and we'll build some more of these cars, and we'll go to Europe with them. So that gave us money to build another 5 cars. So there were a total of 6 Daytonas built. And we had such a small operation in Venice that we couldn't build 6 more cars. And because we were taking the car to Europe, the guys that built the car had kind of gone to Europe with the car. So we made a deal to build the bodies for the next 5 cars, and those were all built in Modena, Italy. So the car was half built in the United States, half built in England, who made the chassis, and a third built in Italy. So this whole combination with this strange-looking car went out, and the bottom line is that we smoked the Ferraris everywhere we went. We put a different driver in it, whether it was Phil Hill at Spa or Joe Schlesser at Le Mans, whatever. We set the lap record, and the car was just on fire, and it completely changed Ford's opinion of what Shelby was, because at that time, you know, all they'd originally put a few bucks behind them just to beat the Corvettes. That's all they really cared about.
Right.
But Carroll had this thing about wanting to go to Europe, and he convinced them that we had a car to do it with. And they said, well, you know, don't worry about it. We bought this Lola design, and we're redesigning it. We're going to go to Europe, and we're going to win it. And, of course, it could, you know, corporate inertia. The car wasn't getting done. It wasn't getting done. It wasn't getting done. And we're out there winning race after race. So Henry Ford looks at the thing, and he says, okay, we'll back you guys all the way through the season, which they did. And we ended up winning the world championship in 1965 with it. Ford did not finish one race in 1964. They came out with the GT40, and the car was basically a major failure beginning.
Yeah.
And everything they did, they broke. They wouldn't finish or whatever. So by the end of the year, you know, the Deuce looked at it and said, we're taking this problem and taking it away from John Wire, who had been given the program to run it in England. And we're going to give the whole thing to Shelby in 1965, which they did.
Well, Pete, let me ask you, so what you're telling me, and I've never heard this part of the story. Without Ken Miles, the Daytona Cobra doesn't exist. Is that fair?
Exactly.
Wow.
Exactly.
Never knew that.
No, without Ken Miles, it never would have happened. It was Ken that did it. And, of course, the reason that you never heard about it is because there was all of this controversy within the company, and it was not a bad feeling. You know, I mean, people were either for this, against it. And then when it came out to be very successful, there were a lot of guys going, well, you know, I don't want to admit that I'm wrong, but they, you know, went ahead and did it, and we were very successful. And then they became very proud of the whole thing. So Ken's whole status within the company really went to the top, because he was a top development driver. He'd you know, backed the program on it, and we went to Europe with it, and it was successful.
Did you watch Ford versus Ferrari at all? Did you watch the movie?
Oh, of course, yeah. But it's great entertainment, Jim, but there's nothing in there that's correct.
I was wondering, because how can your relationship with Ken Miles, and you're watching a great actor, Christian Bale's playing this role, and I'm sure you guys are watching it going, that's cool, but I don't remember any of this because none of it happened.
Oh, yeah. No, Ken was a complete gentleman. This whole thing about a fight between he and Carol was complete garbage, you know. And it was just, you know, you get some Hollywood scriptwriters and they write this dream And, you know, we tried to tell them, you know, what was, and they said, don't worry, we know what we're doing. We're going to make this film. So even, for example, the guy they picked out to play Phil Remington, you know, went and talked to Remington. He said, you know, he went back to the writers and said, you know, you've got it all along. This guy is an incredible talent. He's the guy that eventually made the Ford GT successful. But it didn't happen until we brought all those cars back from England and redid them completely at Shelby American. But if we had not been successful with a Daytona Coupe and showed what we could do, Ford would never have given the program to Shelby. So the transfer of money from England to California and an unlimited budget, part of the program was, okay, no more Cobras. We're going to concentrate on making the GT40 successful. Because by that time, they had at least $10 million invested in the car.
Wow.
And we only had $100,000 or so in the Daytona. So even though it was faster, they didn't want to admit that this other car was better than the GT40. They had totally invested themselves financially and philosophically in the car. And even though it did not work very successfully at the beginning, they knew that if they gave the car to Carroll and our team, that we would make it a winner. And we did. And we completely re-engineered the car. And in the end, we made it very successful. But in the beginning, the GT40 was really a pile of crap. And the Daytona is the car that convinced Henry Ford that they should give the program to Shelby.
Do you have a Daytona, one of the six?
No, I wish I did.
Who does? Do you know who has them?
Oh, I know everybody that has them. One is in Argentina, one is in Tokyo, and one is in Germany. The other three are in the United States. One's at the Simeon Museum in Philadelphia. Rob Walton of Walmart owns one of them. And the last one belongs to the Miller family, a big family, a wealthy family in Salt Lake City with, 35 dealerships and stuff.
What do you think they're worth? What are they worth?
Basically museum pieces. The last offer on one was about $23 million. So nobody's selling them, but that's the whole story on it. So later, a guy named Jim Price in South Africa, who became the largest builder of replica Cobras roadsters in the world, came to me and said, I want to build a Daytona. And I kind of blew him off because I said, I don't want to really design somebody in the kit car business. And so he said, well, you don't understand. We're a little bit more than a kit car operation. And he gave me some tickets. He said, come down to South Africa. I'll show you what we're doing. And I went down there, and he's got this beautiful operation with about 300 people that he's trained these black farmers how to build automobiles and, really increase the economic area of that part of South Africa, John, and at Port Elizabeth. And so I went down there and I said, okay, I'll redesign the car for you. So I said, the problem with it for a nice GT car, which you want to sell is it really doesn't have enough room in it, because our original rules were that we could not change the chassis. We had to stay with that roadster chassis. And if we did that and put the body on it, there just simply wasn't a lot of room inside it. So I said it was very difficult and hot and uncomfortable for the guys that drove the race cars. So we can't do that for the GT car. So let's extend the wheelbase 3 inches. And I'll redo the body and refine it, and that's what we did. So we've made about 200 of those, and I do have one of those, and they are beautiful. And you will see probably two or three of them out at the M1.
Oh, actually, when we did the first press event, Pete, and one of them was there at the as we were talking about the American Speed Festival, I just stood there staring at it, and you're looking at it, and I'm trying to, in my mind's eye, figure out like the whole story you just told, Pete, and I'm like, so when you look at that car, do you get a rush of memories?
Oh, absolutely. That's the car that the very first car that I got to do totally on my own. You know, when I did the Stingray, I'm working under Bill Mitchell, and I did the entire concept car. It's called the XP87, the actual production car that came out after that was done by Larry Shinoda and Tony Lapine.
Huh. Right.
But I did the prototype, and I
I'm sorry to interrupt, Pete, but wasn't that the story that like Bill kept your drawing in his drawer and would just pull it out and show it, people go,
yeah,
can you
yeah,
is that true?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Because the studio head was wanting that Mitchell was going to, you know, take his work, and he put it up, you know, with everybody else's, and Mitchell went over and picked my stuff out. So he took it off the wall and hit it. So the next time Mitchell came in, he'd look around, and Mitchell was brilliant. You know, I mean, he could come in a week later and say, didn't that line change here? Where's that drawing that I saw? And he had to admit that he took it out of his drawer and put it back up on the wall. And Mitchell said, okay, that's it. And he pointed to all the rest of us. I mean, there were four of us in there, and he said, okay, this is the direction we're going, but now your job is to make something better than this drawing. And he says, I'll be back in a few days, and I want to see what you did. So it was the whole repeat again. You know, we all put our work up on the walls and stuff. And he walked around carefully and looked at it and picked another one off the wall and said, okay, who did this? And again, I raised my hand. And he said, okay, this is it. So here's this drawing I did in November of 1957. And if you look at it, it's the production car that came out in 63.
And how old were you when you did that drawing?
19.
Good Lord.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was, you know, it was super to work with Bill Mitchell. And it was all in his direction. He gave the theme on it. But everything that was done on the car was directed by myself. And it's called the XP87. It's called the Mitchell Stingray. It was the very first concept. It will also be out at the M1. You'll see it. So you'll see that car out there. Mike Simcoe from GM is allowing them to bring that car out there.
Really?
So you'll see the XP87. You'll see the Daytona Coupe. You'll see the last car that I did for Shelby, which is what we call the Shelby Can-Am, which was built as a spec racer for the SCCA. And in two versions, there was a low-powered version that we did with Dodge Power, and then we did a later version that we put an Indy twin cam Indy 500 motor in. It's got over 500 horsepower. And that's in a personal collection to William Deary from Jackson, Michigan, right there. And we're going to have that car there as well. So we're going to have some pretty neat cars up there. I'm really excited to see them all. I know you will be, too.
Yeah. American Speed Festival, AmericanSpeedFestival.com. It's going on this Friday through Sunday. AmericanSpeedFestival.com for tickets, presented locally by Comerica Bank. Pete Brock with us, and I can't wait to be out there. But real quick, did you get a giggle at all? Did you see, like, when they brought out the Hornet, Dodge brought out the Hornet, they're a little small, but the one version was GLH, go like hell?
Yes, absolutely.
Nice. I thought that was a nice touch. I thought that was a nice little move by them.
Oh, yeah. It's very interesting because the whole sort of Shelby community doesn't really want to admit that there was cars that Shelby did for Chrysler that were actually faster than all the Mustangs.
Those were missiles.
Oh, I know. You know, again, that Shelby team he put together made a really little rocket ships out of those cars, and they were very, very successful. But they don't have the mystique and the look and stuff that all the stuff that I designed into the GT350 or the Daytona and stuff. But they were very, very successful. And as they say, the last car that we did with that team with a Dodge motor in it was called the Shelby Can-Am. And it was a spec racer done for the SCCA that guys who are seriously about moving up into a professional series could buy this car with a spec motor in it from Dodge. And SCCA would put this series on. And the problem was that the head of the SCCA at that time was the major distributor for all the Lolas and the Lotuses and the and the trick cars that came over. So he was not in favor of having an American car that was faster and cheaper than that. So they kind of pushed that thing aside, and they only built about 25 of them. And then the program died. At that point, Carroll got pissed off and left and went back with General Motors. And that's when we built the one with the GM motor in it.
Okay. Well, see, I'm learning more here. Pete, we will see you here this week. I'd take you out to dinner, but I'd imagine you're going to be all over God's green earth. You probably got so many friends here in Detroit.
I do. I've got a lot of great friends, and I'm really looking forward to getting to see what's going on and go back through GM styling and and see what's happening there. So it's a pretty exciting time going on.
It's
and
an
we'll
honor.
See you there, Jim.
Absolutely. Pete Brock, ladies and gentlemen. Have a great day, Pete. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most fans of country music, we're excited to learn that Luke Combs was back in the studio working on his next album. We've come up with our list of iconic Luke Combs music videos. Yes, Lovin' On You made the cut. Text Luke to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Luke to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.